This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On a day-to-day basis, most of us probably think a bit more about where our next paycheck is coming from than our total assets, which would be our wealth. But the latter has much more long-term and far-reaching consequences. Wealth is what lets families transfer income over time and build up reserves to pay for big expenses like college or starting a business or get through a rough patch without serious consequences. But not everyone in the country has the same access to wealth building. And the racial wealth gap in our country is staggering. Typical white households have 10 times the wealth of a typical black household. Why is that true, and what is the solution? My guest today can show that it lies beyond income and education. Joining us now is Marissa Baradaran. She's a law professor at the University of Georgia School of Law and author of the new book, The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. Marissa, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book traces black wealth from the end of slavery to today. And there are some staggering statistics about how little wealth has been built in that time. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I mean, 1865, when the slaves are emancipated, and you know they own freedmen and free blacks have about 0.5% of the nation's wealth at the time, and that makes sense because there was lots of restrictions on property ownership, especially for in the South. Today, that number has barely budged. It is about 1 to 2%. So any efforts at wealth accumulation for the black community have been an utter failure. And this is very much in line with what your previous guest was talking about with government policies and explicit racial covenants, redlining, Jim Crow era restrictions. And the thing with patterns of wealth, once they're created, they're really hard to upset. And so we think that there has to be continued discrimination. And that's one story, certainly, that Aaron told. And that's a very important story. But there's another economic story of once you have a racial wealth gap that is that wide, it continues to self-perpetuate without actually continuing input. And this is the story I tell. It's the economic story that wealth just creates more wealth unto itself. And the lack of wealth also has this vicious cycle downwards. And so you don't actually need, you know, banks to be racist, although certainly there seems to be some findings that they are. But even a race-neutral credit score or race-neutral applications will continue to self-perpetuate that racial wealth gap, because without wealth, you have poor credit, you have more debt, you have, you know, lower sort of ladders out of poverty. And all of these cycles are very much economic. And this is the story that I'm telling as far as how the racial wealth gap itself needs to be disrupted.
Tell us more about, forgive me, but tell us more about how this might work. Because once you lift the legal barriers, legal segregation and legal discrimination, you would hope that then some kind of equality would begin to build in and that wealth would build slowly. But you make an excellent point that once wealth has billowed in one particular area, it makes it more difficult for others to then become part of this. But how does that work? Explain why it wouldn't be so that once the barriers were lifted, I could now pass on wealth to my children and things would start to change.
Because the way that wealth was created, especially in this century, I mean, go back, you know, to earlier centuries, but in this century, you know, these FHA mortgage subsidies, these student loans, this was the way that intergenerational wealth was created for the American middle class. So if your grandfather got a FHA subsidized mortgage, that means he was paying less for his mortgage than he was for rent. So that's a nest egg that then gets passed down, and the children are able to borrow from that in literal and figurative ways to build their own wealth, right? So they can go to better schools, they can get loans that are at a lower rate, they can live in areas of homeowners. And so that has all of these compounding effects. Whereas, you know, those redlined areas where black populations were not able to get those mortgages, that just has another self-perpetuating cycle of debt, right? A third of black families have zero wealth or negative wealth. So what that means is any upset, any sort of, you know, sharp financial object that they're going to run into is going to keep them further into debt. Right? So when you don't have that buffer, it tends to self-perpetuate. I mean, when Lyndon Johnson passes the Civil Rights Act, he understands this at the time. He says, look, we're not saying there's equal footing at this point, right? We tend to think that we're in this colorblind situation, but we never fixed the sort of, you know, problems that we created in the first place through government policy. So once that wealth was sort of taken away from the black neighborhoods and put into white neighborhoods or just subsidized over there, then that has to be reversed in some way. It's not going to reverse itself because, you know, I follow bank balance sheets and I show exactly how through deposit taking and lending, these institutions that are whose role is to create wealth are just part of a network. They can't, there's no way to control money when you don't have it. Capital makes more capital. You can't create wealth without wealth to start with.
Well, talking about that network, I think, is a very important point because along the way, efforts to address this wealth gap, and there had been some in the latter part of the 20th century, focused mostly on something we can roughly call black capitalism. That is, pointing to black-owned banks and saying, okay, it's your responsibility to do this. Let's see if you can fix it. To talk about that movement and a little bit of what's wrong with that kind of thinking in a global capital market.
Yeah, so black banks, and this is, you know, since the Emancipation Proclamation, the first black bank is the Freedmen's Savings Bank, and the idea is we're going to, you know, have separate but, you know, equal institutions for black, borrowers and lenders than we are for whites. And the, you know, the same sort of ideology that leads to separate and unequal in the education context is applied to banks. But I show here that it doesn't work. You can't separate money. You can separate communities. You can separate homes. But you can't segregate money. Money is going to flow into the network of money. And so you can have a black bank that has black depositors and loans into black neighborhoods. But that money is going to eventually end up in the holders of property. Those are the people who hold the assets. And that's how banks work, is that they're able to multiply money, but only insofar as they're part of an integrated network of other banks that are lending and borrowing from each other. And so over time, these black banks have operated like a sieve, where they've been able to take this money, but it's kind of leaked out into the community, into the mainstream white community. This is why, you know, Bank of America controls all of the money. Money likes to go where other money is. It's this, you know, the parable of the talents effect, right? So you're going to, you know, congregate money in money centers, and those communities that are disenfranchised will continue to be disenfranchised, and banks won't reverse that. But the black capitalism framework has had this, you know, dark underbelly as well. I mean, part of it is a very, you know, noble effort by black communities to do for themselves, you know, be self-reliant when they've been left out of the white mainstream banks. And that is an admirable and laudable sector that continues to this day. But there's this cynical aspect, too, that I tell in the book is after the civil rights era laws where opened up the barriers to trade, in the Nixon administration, there was no forward motion on civil rights. And what Nixon proposed was black capitalism. And what black capitalism meant was instead of actual, you know, reparations or any integration programs, we're just going to throw more black businesses into these segregated poor neighborhoods and hope that they fix it. And so that's been a political maneuver that I'm trying to highlight, which is part of the Southern strategy.
Forgive me for it. Yes, part of the Southern strategy. And you point out in the book that while it was a talking point and a rhetorical talking point, there was never any real engine behind it or any material resources. I want to bring Sandy Darity into the conversation now. He's a professor of public policy at Duke University and the director of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity. Sandy, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be back.
We've been talking mostly in this segment, at least, about banks and their role in all of this. You hear from a lot of folks that perhaps one of the causes of the wealth gap is education, an education gap. But you point out that that cannot be solely responsible for what we're seeing.
Yeah, but first I'd like to applaud Mercer for an excellent book. But the conventional things that people think will cure the problem don't seem to do so, particularly when we're looking at wealth or net worth, which is the difference between what you own and what you owe. So, for example, if we looked at educational attainment, blacks who have a college degree have 2/3 of the net worth of whites who never finished high school. blacks who are in the third quintile of the income distribution have lower levels of wealth than whites who are in the lowest quintile of the income distribution. And blacks working full time have less wealth than whites who are unemployed. So working hard, gaining additional education and the like doesn't seem to have much of an effect on closing the gap in wealth between blacks and whites. And I think that the primary reason for that is that the wealth gap is due to the intergenerational transfers of resources. And so the key question then becomes, why is it black parents and grandparents actually have less to deliver to their children in the way of bequest or gifts? And I think that some of the things that are factors are subjects that your previous speakers talked about. But one of those is the initial failure to provide 40 acres and a mule to the formerly enslaved black folks after the Civil War ended. Those folks still proceeded somehow to accumulate about 15 million acres of land. If they had been given the 40 acres, it would have amounted to closer to 45 million acres of land. But they somehow managed to accumulate 15 million acres of land, which was progressively reduced by land takings and seizures by whites in the South during the Jim Crow era. And then in communities that developed some significant measure of prosperity, cities like Tulsa, Oklahoma's black community and the like, we had a wave of white massacres that resulted in the destruction of black lives and the destruction of black property.
Wilmington, North Carolina.
Wilmington, North Carolina was one of the first cases, yeah. And then finally, there's a set of policies that were inaugurated in the aftermath of World War II, policies that are probably the most significant efforts at increased or improved social mobility that the United States has ever undertaken. Those policies were associated with the GI Bill and with the development of a federal home loan subsidy program. And unfortunately, again, those policies disproportionately benefited whites because of the way in which the programs were administered, relying heavily on decentralized local control over the execution of the programs. And so throughout many of the communities, especially in the South, blacks were deprived of the opportunity to benefit from
and,
them.
And Marissa, you point out that when you're deprived of these opportunities and, again, not able to build wealth at the same rate, you become much more vulnerable when the bad times hit. So you remind us in your book that 53% of the wealth of black communities was wiped out in 2008. And that's because of the vulnerability of a population that hadn't been able to build wealth. But you also point out – go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, I was working on Wall Street at the time, before the financial crisis, and I've interviewed tons of mortgage brokers. And what happened is when Wall Street became hungry for subprime credit, which is very, very costly credit, they went and they targeted black communities. And this was specific. This wasn't, you know, people who were otherwise prime borrowers were getting sold subprime loans. I've had brokers tell me that they weren't allowed to, or they were not incentivized to, heavily not incentivized to sell any prime loans into these neighborhoods. And so when the financial crisis hits, and it's a subprime crisis, 53% of the wealth of the black community is wiped out because they've been peddled these subprime loans. And so this is the flip side of deprivation is exploitation. When you've deprived these communities of that good credit, that subsidized government FHA credit, and they are left without it, all of a sudden when Wall Street decides to give high cost credit, that's where it goes. And so you see, and same with the payday lenders. When community banks leave, the payday lenders come and fill the void. And there's an exact, you know, you can draw the red lines and you can look within those red lines and you can see the more payday lenders, more subprime credit, the highest cost credit is in there. And before that, it was installment credit, where outside in the white suburbs, you've got revolving credit card credit, which is very low interest, low risk. And inside the ghetto, you've got installment credit that is very expensive. It is onerous. There's repo men and police, and it's just a two different credit markets. I mean, I call it a Jim Crow credit market. Mm-hmm. It's separate and completely unequal.
Sandy Darity, what do we do now?
Okay, there's
Sandy,
the question.
Fix it. You've got 5 minutes.
So I've been thinking about two sorts of solutions. One of these solutions is outlined in a new book that's forthcoming by Kirsten Mullen and myself on reparations for Black Americans. So obviously, since I've invoked that word, that means that what we're going to argue in the book is that one of the significant ways in which you could move to close the racial wealth gap is to have a substantial program of reparations for African Americans, so you could directly tackle those disparities.
And forgive me for interrupting, but you have pointed out that it's reparations not just for the period of enslavement, but for the period that followed.
That's right. Well. So, in fact, one could make the argument that the stronger case for reparations might be associated with the period after the end of slavery, where a set of active public policies were in place or actions were permitted by public officials that sustained and in some cases widened the racial wealth gap. So that's absolutely right. But there is also another option, which has been advocated by Derek Hamilton, who's an economist at the New School, and myself, which is to have a program that could be put in place which is not specific to Blacks. It's a universal program, but it could be designed in such a way that it would work to the relative advantage of those folks who had the least wealth. And so since Blacks have the least wealth, then there could be a disproportionate benefit from that.
So an income-based program, and how does it work?
Actually, it's a wealth-based program.
Wealth-based program, okay.
And we call it the baby bonds proposal, but it's not really a bond. It's a trust fund for each newborn infant. And so the premise here is that wealthy parents give their kids a trust fund frequently. So why shouldn't every child have a trust fund? And this trust fund would be publicly funded and publicly provided. What would be special about the program we have in mind is that we would vary the amount of the trust based upon the child's family's wealth position. And so kind of in the stump speech that I give about this program, I say, you know, if Bill Gates had another child, we'd give them a $50 trust fund. But for children who are born into families at the lowest end of the wealth distribution, we'd give them a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund. And so the idea here is that we try to correct for some of the disparities that exist in wealth and give every child upon adulthood an asset that can provide them with the opportunity for economic security and further accumulation.
The interesting thing about that is that trust is then invested and it goes out in the big wide world of capital while we're waiting for the child to reach 18. And in the meantime, and then after that or even in that period, it is spent into the economy. So it would have a multiplier effect, would it not?
It could, depending on how you structured the program. So our idea is that the government would guarantee a 1% real rate of interest on these funds. And so if that was accomplished by investing the funds throughout the economy, then you could definitely have that effect.
Which we have not done with Social Security, alas.
No, we have not.
Had you done that, it would have been a big boon for Wall Street. But oh no, we didn't. Well, the prospects for this in this political environment, I hesitate to ask.
So no, don't hesitate. I mean, we have to go full steam ahead with these things, even if we're pessimistic about how quickly they can be adopted. I think that obviously under the terms of the existing Congress, it's unlikely that we'll have a national program of this type. But I certainly think that there's a reasonable prospect for changing the Congress as we know it and having elected officials to be more receptive to developing this type of proposal. And there has been some interest that's been expressed by some members of the U.S. Congress, including Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland.
Marissa, I've given you 30 seconds, sadly, to answer this. So roughly speaking, how does that sound to you?
I think that sounds great. I mean, we have to the racial wealth gap was created by government policy, and government has to be explicit in fixing it. We need truth and reconciliation. We need reparations. And whatever that looks like, and there's a lot of people doing great work, especially Sandy and Derek. But the idea is that I'm just trying to educate people what won't work. And what won't work is letting capitalism fix the problems that social policy created.
Marissa Baradaran is a law professor at the University of Georgia Law School. Her new book is The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. Thank you so much, Marissa.
Thank you for having me.
Sandy Darity, professor of public policy at Duke University, director of the Samuel Dubois School Cook Center on Social Equity. Sandy, thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Both guests are going to be at an event at the UN School of Law in Chapel Hill this coming Tuesday. We have all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Flamenco music is coming up on the State of Things. Stay tuned.